You are listening to episode 2 on the Circle of Mothers podcast.
Hi, welcome to the Circle of Mothers. I am Linda Tao and I will be your host. This podcast is dedicated to inspiring you to confidently raise your child in a world where parents are bombarded with do's and don'ts. In the podcast, I interview with remarkable mothers from all walks of life who share their parenting experiences, beliefs, strategies, struggles, and triumphs. So let's join together to create an encouraging circle of mothers.
Welcome back, mothers, fathers, parents, friends, families, and loved ones. Thank you for joining us today again. What I have prepared for you, I know without a doubt you will love. I have another extraordinary mother with me, Kua. What an honor to have you to join us today, Kua. Thank you so much and welcome.
Oh, thank you for having me with you today.
So Kua and I first met at a conference 2 years ago and then again at a women's retreat earlier this year where Kua directed a 3-day workshop within 3 hours. She is just an overall strong, beautiful, and generous person and an absolute philanthropic human being. I truly mean that because when I reached out to her about this podcast, Kua did not hesitate at all. And knowing her, she is an incredibly busy woman and wears so many hats, as you will learn today. So I truly am honored for our time together. So Kua, why don't we just go ahead and get started? Share with us your story. Who are you? Where are you from? And what was it like growing up?
Thank you again, for this opportunity to be part of your podcast. I think when you reached out and you were talking about this idea of just talking about motherhood, especially being a mom mother, and to kind of discover that a bit, because I actually feel like this is something really new to a lot of Hmong women, because what we don't realize is like our mother actually were parents and mother of like a different world, in a different time. And it's not just time, but world in general. So I myself, grew up in Thailand. I was actually only 2 when my parents arrived here to the United States. So I was born in the refugee camp in Camp Vinai. My parents came to the United States in 1983 and actually landed in San Francisco. And then my brother at that time, my brother who's older than me by 2 years at that time, actually was sick with chickenpox. And we were traveling, imagine that, with chickenpox, and he had a fever and he was just a baby, I imagine like a 4-year-old, and with my parents not being able to speak English, I can just only imagine what they had to go through. But we landed in San Francisco, and usually what they do is they process you, like refugees, process you, find your sponsor, send you out from San Francisco. And my parents, after my brother got better, was able to go to Denver, Colorado, where my uncle and extended families were. So we grew up in Denver, Colorado, which a lot of people don't know that about our family, but we stayed there for about 2 years, and then we decided to kind of move with relatives here to Sacramento. And since then, we've been in Sacramento. I myself am one of 11, wonderful siblings. There's 6 girls, 6 boys. The last 2 are twins. And we're just like a huge, kind of regular family, actually large Hmong family.
You've mentioned growing up with 11 other siblings. Where do you fall in between all the siblings, and what was it like growing up with so many brothers and sisters?
So it's kind of strange because it's an even number. So when you count it, I have 3 older brothers and 3 older sisters. So that makes me the 7th child. And so, but then when you count it the other way, there's 3 younger brother and then 2 younger sister. And so that makes me number 6. So I'm 7th oldest and 6th youngest, I guess. Yeah, I'm right in the middle. Yeah.
So what was it like growing up with so many brothers and sisters?
So, it's been a while for me to kind of think back when growing up, but I can tell you, like, our household was never boring. The fact that you had so many kids, we were able to play all the sports. I mean, we had a baseball team, we had a football team, we were able to play soccer. There's just enough kids around to actually do that. And then growing up in the early 90s and 80s, it was really difficult for our Hmong community too, because we were just like a young community. And a lot of time, you know, also living in a, like a poor neighborhood. And a lot of time there was a lot of just, you know, gang violence or violence in general in the neighborhood. So my parents really didn't let us go out much. So a lot of time we were just together, you know, my sibling and I and cousins that would come over. And yeah. And so that was one thing I just realized. And the other thing too is like, when we watched our videos when we were smaller, like we were always speaking Hmong. And that was something that was quite interesting because, you know, as an adult, you know, I still speak Hmong. My fluency, you know, changes depending on the situation. Like if I haven't spoke Hmong for a while, it's hard for me to get the fluency in. But if I speak it for a while, then it makes my tongue much more smoother and I'm actually able to speak Hmong fluently. But that was all because of my parents, you know, what they did was they taught us Hmong and that's all they spoke to us. But I just remember that, like, every time we watched it, we were like, oh, my God, look at the amount of Hmong we were speaking back and forth. So it was just fun. I mean, the household was just, you know, full of kids. And then, you know, as we all grew up together, you know, it was also opportunity to experience that together. Again, you know, my older siblings, I think they had it a lot rougher because they were in their teenage years when they arrived in a whole new different country and had to speak a different language and a whole new culture. So, you know, obviously my older brothers and them, you know, had their challenges as well. And then, you know, my older sister, you know, the same with her, you know, having to adjust to the different culture and, you know, just the amount of like, you know, back then it wasn't like nowadays in our school where like bullying is a crime, you know, where, you know, there's ways you can actually approach and talk to kids about it or parents can work things out. You know, back then, none of this exists. So, you know, I think when you think about like parenting and being a mom, you know, my mother had to deal with a lot of things that she just, you know, had to do the best she could. And I think that's, you know, one of those things where when people always talk about Hmong people, I feel that that ability to have that, you know, preservation or to preserve or to what's the right word? Like, just, you know, to be able to go through hard things and still come out on the other side and to know that it may be difficult, but you got to just push through. And
resilience?
Yeah, that resiliency. There we go. Yeah, that. Yes, yeah, I was thinking of that. Yeah, and that's something that I think that traditionally and through, you know, our culture, you know, we're pretty resilient, you know, as a community. And, you know, that's something that, you know, I saw my mom doing and my dad doing and my older siblings. And me, myself, you know, growing up in South Sacramento, you know, very little opportunity, but wanted to preserve and kind of have that resiliency within myself to want to explore. And then my family had opportunities to go to college. So I wasn't the first one to go to college, but I was the first one to go away from college, like from home to go to college, to leave the home. And I just remember that itself was like very interesting because my parents just couldn't understand the concept of like, why would it, like my daughter, you know, you're a daughter, you don't go away, you know, you don't live by yourself. You only do that when you get married, you know? And I just, you know, remember that conversation with my mom, my dad, and the answer was always no, you know, go to Sac State, go to UC Davis if you want to go somewhere, you know? And I was like, no, you know, I really want to get out of this city. Because, you know, by then I was already thinking about how, you know, sometime, and I was already like, in a way, being like a systems thinker already, right? So back then I was already understanding that there's like all this issue happening in my community and within my neighborhood. And, you know, you can't fix the issue with the same, you know, like issues are occurring. So if you're in the same environment, that environment sometimes can't fix itself. You have to pull yourself out of that in order for you to see it from a different perspective, or maybe there's something external that can actually come in and help your, you know, can help your community. And that was something I really wanted to do, was like get out of Sacramento. And I didn't go very far. I think I had many options, but ultimately at the end, you know, I had wanted to go to UC San Diego, and I actually got in and I showed my mom like where it was. And she was like, "What's that?" And I was like, "Mexico, right?" And she was like, "No, that I couldn't go to Mexico, you know?" And she was like, "You're going so far, you're next to Mexico." And I was telling her, "Well, you know, fine, you know, then can we compromise somewhere?" So I had applied to UOP, and then, you know, UOP also accepted me. And so that was the compromise, that I would go to school in Stockton, which is like 40 miles away from Sacramento, and I can stay in the dorms. And when I needed to come and do my daughter responsibilities, you know, I would come home and do that, because we're very traditional. So we still do the, you know, oneng and hupli and all that. So on the weekends, when something like that happens, I would have to drive home and do my daughter duties, you know, wake up at 6 o'clock, do the rice, you know, watch, you know, prep the things. And then when that's all done at the end of the day, drive back, you know, and then stay for the week and do what I can do. Yeah. I had to talk to a lot of uncles, you know, to make them feel like, okay, yeah, she can go. She's not going to shame us, you know, kind of thing. You know, it was like support from my siblings, but especially from my older sister, you know, Gojong, you know, for her to say, you know, that it is something that I want to do, and it's something that she felt that I was capable of doing. And, you know, just having her like explain that to my parents. And then in a way, I just felt like this heavy burden, like, oh my gosh, I can't mess up, you know, because, you know, here my, you know, everyone's kind of putting, you know, themselves on the line. And for me to go and screw up isn't going to work. You know? And so for me, okay, you know, here's an experience. And I just remember like originally it was just going to be me and my sister. All right. And so my older sister was going to drive me, and I was going to just check in, and I was going to meet my roommate, and then and all. And that, and the whole week, like, my mom didn't say anything. But that morning when we were packing and leaving, you know, she was like, "No, I'm going to come too," you know? And she's like, "No, I want to come," you know? And I thought that, you know, that was something like, you know, back then when you're a teenager, you're so into yourself only, and you know, all you can think about is like your own needs and where you want to go. And like, I didn't even think about like my mom and her needs, you know? And I just remember like, I didn't even like talk to her about it. And I just kept telling her, "Oh, okay, I'm leaving, you know, I'm leaving Saturday." And that morning when she woke up, she was like, "No, I'm going to come with you." And so it was her, myself, and my sister. And it was a great experience for her, because I think she saw where I was going. And then she got a chance to really see like the dorms and just that it was going to be okay. But it was strange, because we walked into the dorm hall, and the first door to the left, you had like these guys moving into the room, right? First door to the right, you have like guys moving into the room. And then my room was the next room, you know? She was like, "Oh my gosh, you guys are living with guys," you know? Like, or like, you know, it was just like a whole new thing for her. And for at the same time, I think for myself too, like I just didn't know what college life was going to be like, or what it mean to go away and stay in the dorms and all. So, you know, she was actually experiencing that with me at the same time. And yeah, it was a really special memory, and something that, you know, now that I'm my own, you know, as a parent myself, like just those, like, now I understand where she was. You know, like, I think that when Elizabeth goes away to college, I'm going to go. I want to go check it out. You know, I want her to feel like, you know, I can be part of that experience with her.
It really fascinates me, because you've mentioned your parents came here in the early 80s. So with the first wave of Hmong immigrants into the U.S., had 12 of you guys, raised you guys during a time when the Hmong people haven't really established a sense of belonging yet, but yet they were so open. I can't imagine your parents having to worry about all 12 of you, especially since one child is so different from the next. When you have one child who wants to go away for school, and then you have another child who wants to go into a less common profession, it's scary to try new things, but your parents were very open. I'm starting to piece some things together, and it sounds like your siblings played a role in encouraging your parents to support you guys in the decisions you made. So although your parents might have been afraid, it sounds like your older siblings brought a lot of reassurance.
So I want to say that, because I have an opportunity of having hindsight now, you know, being a parent myself, right? So I want to say that as a parent, you really don't know what is going to happen with your child, and you really don't know how you can best support them. And so I think for my parents, what really happened was, individually, we all wanted to do something, or we all had something that we wanted to try. And what they did was, you know, they were not, you know, the first initial answer is always no, all right? And they were really strict about like our safety. And so, like, you know, there was a lot of things that they just would not allow us to do. And I think it was through this ability for us to kind of still push that boundary, and our parents eventually saying, okay, you know, if someone thinks that this is okay, then we will try, you know. And I think that was always the word try. And growing up, I mean, I remember we're always saying, my older brother will always say to my dad, like, oh no, you know, this is a new fashion, you know, like this is new, you know, like, you know, like you, this is all new, you guys got to be more like in the new, like, and it was always something that my parents and themselves, I mean, I can't speak for them, but, you know, I just feel like if it's anything like what I've gone through with parenting, is that you grow. So every time, every 5 years, every 10 years, you yourself are a different person. So I just feel like my parents were kind of the same thing. You know, like when they first came to this country, they were like, okay, I have 8 kids, right? And I do something to make sure they're fine, right? So find a job, doing that. But 10 years later, you know, they have 12 kids and the older siblings, right? So imagine that, right? My 12-year-old sister is 22, all right? 10 years later, so, you know, you change as a person. And I think that's where your parenting changed, because your kids changed without permission. And, you know, you change along with them. And so I think, you know, if you were to see us when we were a little and with my parents, you know, it was a bunch of like naughty kids and loud and getting in trouble, right? But a lot of time, my parents always got us to, like, you know, say things like, you know, you go to the salmon gina, right? So think about it, you know, like, why are you doing that? You know, go to the sala, like, think about it, right? So I have to say, I credit my parents for teaching me how to self-reflect, you know? And so I think that's the biggest thing, was this whole notion of, like, think about it, you know? We had this rule in the house, because there's so many of us, and, you know, a lot of time we didn't have a lot. So the rule is, you can't bring anything home unless you can share with everyone. So if you have, like, candy or you had something, right, if it's not going to be enough for everybody, you don't bring it home. You finish it and you come, because it's just not fair, you know? And it's just like, and it's always been something that I do that with my kids now too, you know? Like, if you have something and you're not gonna share, finish it before you come home, because when you get here, you're gonna have to share with everybody. So yeah, just that whole thing about, like, you gotta think about other people's feelings if you're eating that in front of them and they can't eat it, right? So I think, you know, because there's so many of us and we're all so different, yeah, my parents really taught us to, like, really self-reflect and think about other people's feelings. And so in a way, like, they were already developing those SEL skills in us, you know, like being socially emotional, and being able to, like, understand other people's feeling and having empathy and, like, sharing. And we had to share a lot, you know, and, like, you know, understanding personal space and giving people time, and then, like, being reflective of who you are. And so I just think that that was just what was happening a lot. And a lot of time when you're in that situation, you end up thinking a lot and you start wanting, and if you're curious like I am, you know, you start wanting to do things or check things out or go places. And as much as they were strict at the very beginning, I think that as the siblings, like the older siblings, started to get older, you know, they started to expand my parents', you know, perspective of the world. And at the same time as we were seeing the world grow bigger, they were doing the exact same thing. So, yeah.
Well, your parents just sound really, really, really awesome. And so I just hope one of these days, you know, I'm able to bring your mom on and just ask her, you know, from her perspective. But it just sounds to me like your parents, you know, were very open. They, you know, they had the ability to adapt, which I can see maybe carried on over to the way you parent your kids. And so I want us to just talk about you and your husband. How long have you been married, and when did the first child come into your lives?
Oh, wow. So we have been married since 2004. And so I think we're coming up on our 15-year anniversary as a couple, as a committed couple. But I've known my husband since junior high school. So we grew up in the city of Sacramento together, and, you know, we've been together. I've known of him since junior high school, and then we shared mutual friends in high school. And then eventually in college, you know, had an opportunity to have a relationship, and ended up getting married. So 15 years, you know, of marriage. We were lucky, or I shouldn't say we were lucky. When we got married, we wanted to do so much stuff together as a married couple first that we knew, like, for the first year, we didn't want to have kids yet. Like, we just wanted to see how it was. And, you know, back then, you know, I was just starting off with my career and all. And so it was, it wasn't even anything we were thinking about. And it wasn't until maybe like 2 years and a half into the marriage, did we decide that we want to have kids. And that was because I had gone much more stable in my job, and he also was much more stable in his job. And we felt like it would be appropriate if we, you know, start having kids. So about 2 years in, we start trying. And, you know, you would think that because Guillaume, you know, that my fertility rate would be pretty high, you know, and that my mom, you know, her fertility rate would be pretty high too with her, right? And that I would probably do that. But it was interesting because, you know, we actually tried. We tried for a whole year and like nothing happened, you know, and it was just like, you know, we tried. And, you know, for me, you know, at first I had already thought that maybe it was like the birth controls and stuff like that that I was using. So I even stopped taking that, and I stopped taking it for a year. And again, we were trying that year, and it just nothing happened, right? And so, you know, we were kind of discouraged, and you know, and then finally, you know, the baby came, right? So Elizabeth came into our life like 3 years into our marriage, and it was just one of those things where I think we were trying too hard that it just didn't work, or I just feel like sometimes like the universe knows like when you're ready for a child, you know, and they or that you need the child, or I don't know what it is, but it was just like she came into our life, and yeah, and it was like you learn so much more about your spouse when you have children, right? So for me, you know, Elizabeth came, and I was used to kids because, you know, I grew up, I had to watch my younger brother, you know, the whole babysitting your cousin or your niece, right? Where you have to like feed them, clothe them, you know, give them food and then change their diaper, and you got to carry them, right? And all that kind of stuff. So you know how to hold them, touch them. You're kind of aware of things that the baby might need. My husband was totally new to this whole thing. And so this notion of having a small child, like he told me years later how afraid he was that first time he had to hold Elizabeth. And I was just laughing because I just didn't like register and realize that, you know, that was something he was probably going through. But there was a lot that came, you know, into, you know, having a child together, especially when the child is not Hmong, only 100% Hmong, right? So my husband is white, Caucasian. He's a mix of English and British and German L in him somehow. And so, I mean, now that we had a child, I mean, there was a lot of things that we had to consider. I mean, I think it's always about this whole notion of like the values that you want to have or the traditions you want to create for your family. You know, the good thing about John and our relationship is that early on, like even at the very beginning when we first got together, he understood how important it was, you know, my culture, my tradition, my practice. He was quite supportive of that and open. He himself doesn't believe in God, and you know, he called himself agnostic, right? And so he's pretty open to just, you know, doing what I need to do. So I remember when I was pregnant with Elizabeth, and I was about to, you know, I was getting close to my labor date. You know, traditionally among women, right? Or name kono minjina, right? And so, you know, I'm just fortunate enough to know to have like shamans in my family. So like my older sister Bahua, she's a shaman. And so with me, like when that happened, you know, I was able to sit down with her and ask if she could do like the healing for me so that when I go into labor, you know, we're all fine and stuff. So, you know, he was pretty open with that. And so it was kind of like the beginning of this notion of like, oh, wow, how do you incorporate your traditional practice in with yourself? Because now, you know, when you have children, it's like two circles, you know, coming together, and it's like three circles now, right? So you have the you, and then you have the you and your husband's relationship, and suddenly it's like you and like this other child, or you know, that's part of you, right? And so you're a wife, and now you're a mother, and then you're still you. And so, you know, it's all that you have to work with. And a lot of and then now when you think about the child is both, you know, the mom and dad. And so those values that gets, you know, kind of passed on to the child, you know, can be quite complicated when both parents are not from the same culture or tradition, right? because then there's the question of like, what do you teach them and what do you not teach them? And for me, you know, I've always been like, I'm a learner, so I love learning about all the different religion and people's practice. And at the end of the day, you know, I just respect them all, but I do my own practice. And so for my husband, he's been really open to that. And I think that's been great because my children have been able to experience both, you know, my culture and an ability for them to kind of decide what they want to do as well. But one thing is that you can put whatever you think you want your children to have or do or believe in. When they become their own person, they're going to make their own choice. And so that's like one of those things where I was telling my husband, you know, yeah, we can, you know, I can teach her everything about my culture. You can, you know, tell her about everything about what religion can and can't do. And at the end of the day, you know, they're all going to go decide, you know, when they're older and they're their own person, what they're going to believe in, what they want to practice, and, you know, who and where they want to go.
Several days ago, I read an article on a young lady who is half Black and half Asian. She talked about her struggle with identity because she is not supposed to identify as just one or the other. Whenever she announces that she is Black, people easily accept her, but when she announces herself as Asian, people dismiss her or question her. And the only time when people do not question her is if she announces herself as Blasian. And what is even Blasian? So in all of this, it makes me wonder if you and your husband have encountered similar concerns with your children.
So that is actually something new that we're experiencing right now because Elizabeth is turning 12 this summer. And these last 3 years, she's been much more, you know, going through the whole preteen kind of stage and now kind of much more aware of her body and her image and society's pressure on her image. And also, it's interesting because when you think of her at that age and then you think about like my 8-year-old and my 6-year-old, like my 6-year-old, she's just happy that she's alive and she's happy that she's both mommy and daddy, right? And so she'll be like, yeah, I'm Hmong and I'm Hmong and I'm like, what, Mika, right? Mom, right? And I was like, yeah, you're Hmong and Mika. Or like, I'm Hmong and American, right? And I was telling her, no, American is a nationality thing. So, you know, you can be Hmong and American and, you know, Caucasian and white, you know, and stuff. And so, you know, for her, she's just like, because she hasn't gone to the part where, you know, she starts to understand that, you know, in society, they categorize you, right? And for her, she looks so much more white than my middle one, which is much more closer to looking Asian. So my middle one, when you see her, you can kind of go, oh, okay, maybe she's mixed because she looks kind of Asian, right? And so my Molly, like she right now is just like, you know, kind of starting to ask that question, you know, like, okay, but all three of them always answer that they're mixed and they're half and half. And, you know, I think that the only thing that we have decided on so far as a family is that, you know, when it comes to checking a box, that they're going to check the box that will give them the most advantage. And so whatever they want to do that, they can do that, you know. But my older one, Elizabeth, being a teenager herself now, and like, she doesn't carry a lot of Hmong features. Because again, sometimes like I don't look like the typical Hmong lady too. So I don't have a lot of those features. And then like when I'm with my kids, like it's interesting because then when you look at my kids and they're just with one parent, it's kind of like a missing puzzle kind of thing, right? But the moment the other spouse comes into the picture, everyone's like, oh, I get it, right? So it's like all the time, like my husband would be like with them and then I show up and they'd be like, oh, okay, I get it now. Like, okay, like that's the mix, you know? And all three of them do look in a way where they just don't look like Hmong and Asian. And so sometimes, you know, I do get the look sometimes when I'm with them too. Like people would ask a polite question of like, are they all yours? You know, and I was like, yes, they're all mine, you know, meaning I like, you know, that they're questioning a bit. But yeah, so we haven't gotten there yet where they're saying like, oh, I just want to be this, you know? And I'm hoping that we never get to that because you know, one of our values that we try to raise for our kids is that it's so important to know who you are and where you came from because that does determine who you are. Like it contributes to that and you have to acknowledge it and then you move on. You know, how you want to move forward is totally up to you, but you got to acknowledge, you know, your heritage. And that's why, you know, when I it wasn't until we had children too did John start kind of questioning about his heritage a bit too, because my kids were do like their their family tree or something, and then they will ask like who is from where and what culture are they, right? And it wasn't until then did my husband start asking his father about where did grandpa come from and where did grandma come from, right? And I was married with him for about 10 years, and then I found out that his grandmother came from England. So it was like that, like he was finding it out, or in a way, I felt like he was just probably not as interested, and like when it became important, he started to start talking about it more or something. But it was interesting because it wasn't until we had children did he start questioning, his genetic makeup and his heritage and where his family came from.
That is interesting, which leads me to another interesting topic. When you sent me your bio, I read that you were a Waldorf parent. And so that makes me curious, what is Waldorf parenting? Because I've heard so many different parenting styles, from Montessori to attachment parenting, or the most commonly heard, Bonbrun parenting. But the one less heard of is Waldorf parenting, which I just learned because it is your choice of parenting. So will you explain to us what Waldorf parenting is?
So I'm not an expert in Waldorf teaching, but basically Steiner Rudolph is his name. He created this method around teaching based upon children's developmental growth. So the whole idea is that you don't teach a child certain type of information or pressure them to read, let's say, until developmentally their body is ready for that. And so when I put that I'm a Waldorf parent, it just signifies that, we believe in the Waldorf practice. Our all three children go to a public Waldorf school. Our oldest one went to a private Waldorf for about 3 years until we had the other kids and we couldn't afford taking her there. And so, so it's a curriculum. It's a way, a practice of how, and a mindset of how teachers teach. It's all about the fact that kids learn through play, and that kids learn through actual doing stuff, like with their hands. So there's a saying about like open mind, open heart, open hand. It's kind of like a logo that they or a tagline that they tend to have. And it's pretty much just this notion that, kids are developmentally ready at a certain age or a certain practice. So for example, a child is not ready to read until their first tooth breaks. So it's kind of like that. Like when you hear your first tooth, it's a sign of like that baby tooth leaving you. So then it means that you're mentally, physically are ready to start learning how to read. And usually when you think about it, right, you lose your first teeth in kindergarten, right? Or actually at 5 or 4 or so. But it's based on like this notion that a child is ready for certain things at a certain time, and that not everybody is the same way. So for example, my kindergarten, she can go to first grade unless she can hop on one leg with her eyes closed. So there's this notion that then the balance in the body is there, and therefore the mind is actually ready, like the brain is ready to process additional type of information. So it's just a curriculum. It's a way of teaching kids. And I got to tell you, okay, so I got a lot of pushback too about my own family, about raising my kids at Waldorf, okay? And it's because your child has to do 2 years of kinder, they have to be ready, right? And so my Elizabeth and my Molly are basically 1 year behind like their cousins and stuff, because they did 2 years in kinder until they went to the next level. And like my kids are really bright and smart and all, I gotta say, but we don't let them read until they're third grade. And it's just stuff like that like my families are like, oh, you should be getting to do more, or like, well, why are you holding them back, and to be a Waldorf parent, you really do have to be patient about the growth of your child. And I've seen it, and what they say is that it's one of those things where kids can read because it's just a way of decoding things. But just because they can read, if they don't have real life experience or they don't have anything behind it, there's no context behind it, they could be reading, but they can't be comprehending what's actually happening around them. So it's just a different way of teaching, and it's a it's a mindset. And if you're a parent, then you kind of, you know, when you hear a Waldorf parent, you kind of know like what kind of practice your kids are probably doing. You know, they sing a lot, they memorize things. Everything's done. They do needlework, which I love. And so there's this notion around the correlation between handwork, your handiwork, and how your brain functions. And so like all my girls know how to sew clothes, and they all know how to knit, and they all know how to create, like do like a can of wax, you know. So and then they all, like, there's a huge emphasis on art. So everything's expressed through color. And so, you know, they do that. And it's something that, like, being in the education world myself, like, I myself really encourage, you know, this type of like whole child education kind of focus, because it's not just about like the facts or the data or the information or how much he can remember, but the teacher actually, you know, really focused on the entire whole child. So they, you know, like for example, you know, my first grader who's going to second grade this next school year, you know, the way they learn the letters is that, you know, first they draw it, and so for example, if it's the letter M, right, then the image for the day would be like a mountain, and so they can see the M in mountain, and then they understand M is for mountain, and they may even do like a play with the word M in it somewhere, or mountain, right? And so it's both like, it's a experiential learning kind of environment.
I love that. Yeah, I love that. You know, and I agree with you that kids learn best through play. And I think back, I think about our parents, and a lot of our parents, you know, when your kids aren't, if a kid isn't walking by a certain age, then they kind of think that your kid is mentally delayed, right? They tend to say things that, oh, you know, your kid, like my mom always says, huh, when your brother was, you know, your brother was 10 months when he started walking. How come your son's not walking yet? Maybe it's genetic. Maybe it's from your husband's side. You know, my mom tends to do that. And I think it's a lack of education, you know, a lack of understanding of the development of your child. And so I love that you and your husband made that decision to, you know, teach or pair your kids through Waldorf parenting. And so why did you guys decide to go with Waldorf versus all the other kind of, you know, theories out there or practices out there?
Well, I think just like any new parent, you know, when you want to put them into any type of education system, or like when you want to put them somewhere, you know, you want to make sure that it kind of works well with your children, you know. And for us, like, I think, you know, like, because I think what you're asking for is parenting style, all right, versus like a way in which your child is like learning, right? So Waldorf is much more around like how they learn. And it's the parenting style we picked was a parenting style that was going to work for us and our very busy family. And the thing about this is that, you know, the main like parent really was my husband. I mean, with the way in which my job was and where the type of work I was doing, a lot of time, you know, the main like maternal parent, it was, you know, their dad. And, you know, so for us, and knowing that too, like this whole notion of Waldorf education, just like it fills in the things that we're not good at or we won't have time to do as much, you know. So for us, you know, that just worked for us because we were so, you know, in a way, it also made us slow down in the way in which we did things too, because, you know, our kids were reminding us of things like, oh, you know, we gotta slow down, you know. But so as far as parenting style, like, it's hard for me to explain it because in our dynamics, you know, my husband, you know, is much more patient with them, and he's like the main like parent. And for me, like in the last, you know, 12 years of, you know, being a mother, you know, I'm actually finally at a place right now where I'm home much more, and that I'm actually with my last girl much more. And for me, you know, our parenting skill or our parenting style has always been this notion of like, okay, listen to your kid and know that things will be different for each child. For us, you know, I mean, we're big, like, the work that I do and the work that my husband believes in, you know, we're all about like youth development, right? Like we're about giving young people opportunity to be heard and to have opportunities to grow and experience. And so when it comes to our own kid, you know, we try to do the same thing too. And yeah, at the same time, like you have to be like that authoritative parent sometime, you know, but I gotta tell you, there's no, I just feel like there's no set parenting style. I think whoever came up with this idea that, you know, we gotta categorize ourselves in a certain parenting style, I don't know where that came from, besides the fact that it's a marketing thing and you can get parents to buy things more. I remember watching this one YouTube video about that, you know, where they had like this YouTube video and like all these different type of parents, like the yoga parents and, you know, the busy, the dad group, and they had all these like different, you know, parents. And somehow in the video, like one of the child's stroller got, you know, was knocked over and it was kind of going towards the traffic. And all suddenly everybody ran towards that child, you know, and was trying to save it, you know. And then at the end, they all realized that parenting style means that you just want the best for your kids and you want to do it in a way that you can't, like best for your own situation, you know, because sometimes when I think about like the only mothers that I can relate, like have, you know, relate to is what, like other mothers my age, my mom, you know, and my mother-in-law, right? And then my sisters and them as they have their kids, you know, and like just looking at that, we're all different, you know, and I also think that like we're all in a different, like situations and environment, you know? And I think that if you talk about motherhood, you know, it's hard. You know, I always tell people that motherhood is the one job that, you know, once you get, you can't quit. And, you know, it's like, it's a hard job. And I want to say, as being a parent, it's a hard thing to do because you're kind of like responsible for a child that believes that you have all the answer. And believes everything that you say up until they don't believe you anymore, right? And then suddenly, you know, there's that tension of like, oh, you know, you want the best for them, but they want something else, right? So how do you approach that? And for me right now, like, I'm just starting to get there with my 12-year-old, you know, like this notion of like, should I protect her all the time? Because I know she's about to make a mistake, right? So do I go in and tell her, oh, you're about to make this mistake and you should do it this way? And then have her resent me for that because I'm doing that? Or do I let her fail and like get hurt and then let her go through that and then have her tell me, well, why didn't you tell me, right? Like you gotta make sure that I needed that, you know? And so I think for us, like our parenting style is really just listen to what our kids' needs are, you know, try to be present, you know, and understand exactly, you know, what it is that's happening in that moment. And each of my kids are very different. Like my oldest one, she takes a while before she will actually tell me, you know, what she's feeling or what she's going through. And so for her, you know, being present, meaning actually being next to her and talking to her and, you know, spending separate time with her would get to a point where she will open up. Where, you know, my other two, and they're still really young, so they just want to keep talking and keep telling me everything that happened that day. And then like my middle one, like, you know, she's finally getting to the age where you can kind of start to lie, right? Like you can tell the truth or you can lie and try and manipulate things and get your way, right? And, you know, like just facing that, like figuring out how do you get them to understand that what they're doing, you know, what she's doing is wrong. But when she watched like what's happening in the world around us and seeing that manipulation is something that people do in order to get, you know, where they need to get to, you know, like trying to teach that to your children so that they can know the difference. I really, you know, wouldn't be able to categorize my parenting skill in one of those categories because, yeah, it's just one of those things where, for me, just being available when they need me and just being present with your children. And then just knowing and then forgiving yourself, like giving yourself, you know, space to know that it's all new. Like the thing you're experiencing right now is all new. And you can ask other parents for advice, but, you know, your child and your situation is totally different.
I agree with you. You know, I never thought of it that way, where parenting, what is parenting, right? And parenting, like you said, is just every parent wanting what's best for their kids, you know? And you're right that whatever's being marketed out there, It's just a way to make money, right? And then as a parent, right, we already are struggling with, am I doing this right? Am I doing this wrong? And you have all these things being marketed saying, this is the best way. This is the right way to approach, you know, parenting. And so these are pulling us in different ways. And we're constantly struggling with, oh my gosh, I'm not a good mom, right? And so to help myself, I often do, you know, look up a lot of parenting quotes to remind me to, I guess, do what's right. Right, air quotes, whatever's right. Or I look up articles and I buy books to read. And so I have found so many great things, but I always forget to apply them when, you know, it actually happens, when the situation arises. And so with that being said, I wanted to ask, what has been one of your favorite parenting quote or, you know, mothering, something that really resonated with you as a mother?
So one of my favorite quote, and I think it came out of an anime that I was watching. It was called What's Your Name? All right. But it's this movie, and it's about these two individuals like trying to find each other through time. Like, there's like a little bit of time travel in there. And a quote that the grandmother says to her son is that, you know, children grow without permission. All right. And that has always been something that I've always thought about, because they do, you know. And the thing about time and children is that, you know, if you don't spend time with them now, you know, that's gone. You know, they grow the next day, right? And eventually they become their own person, you know? And so for me, you know, it hits hard for me because I'm always so busy. I'm traveling all the time. I'm either working, you know, in long hours, or when I'm home, I'm working. And that was something that I just like always remind myself about that, you know, children grow without permission. And so if you don't spend time with them now, if you don't enjoy this phase that they're in right now, it goes away, you know. And the next one, you might have another child, but they're going to be totally different, you know. And so, yeah, it's like, it's not the same, you know. And then that's the other thing too, children grow without permission. So if you're in a tough situation where your kid is giving you a hard time, they grow up. They really do. You know, like I talked to my husband and like 12 years ago, you know, I mean, Elizabeth just came to our life and, you know, we were in a different situation. I mean, we were 12 years younger. I mean, when you think about it, right? And we were, you know, and 12 years different in wherever we are in our life. And, you know, just really thinking about it. And now she's 12 and now she's at the phase where she doesn't want to hang out with me, you know? And I'm just thinking like, oh my gosh, you know, where did that 12 years go, right? And so, you know, I'm just thinking about other two younger ones and I'm giving them as much time as I can. And even with Elizabeth right now, you know, I'm not letting this time pass me by. You know, I'm gonna enjoy the, I don't wanna talk to you, mom, or the, you don't know anything, mom, or like, no, you can't be, you know, like, I don't think you know what you're doing, mom, you know, like all that kind of stuff, you know. I'm just enjoying that because I also know that this time will pass and then she's gonna be 21 and she and I could be having, you know, a nice glass of wine one day, you know, chatting, and it'll be just like me doing that with my mom, you know. And I just realized that about like my mom and our relationship, like it really didn't get better until I got older, you know. And you know, I was at a point where, you know, I was then experiencing a lot more in life and asking her questions, and it was the same thing with, you know, just, you know, having a child now. And so you're a parent and a mother, and now you can kind of relate to what your mother was going through. And suddenly everything, you know, changes, you know, that whole perspective of like what was actually happening at that moment in time, you know, really means something different now.
Right. That is such a great quote. We are going to visit this quote again, but I am going to shift gears quickly and talk about the other hat you wear. You shared with me that you are currently the co-owner and innovation and strategic planning consultant at John Gooder LLC. Can you explain to us what John Gooder LLC is? When was it established? What is its purpose?
Yes. So John Gooder LLC is a consultancy that works on personal development and professional development. We go in and we do organizational diagnostics for your organization, so we can help you determine the type of strategy you want to implement to determine, you know, the different type of outcomes you want to be able to achieve, and we give you ways of doing that. And then we also do a variety of event hosting. We throw events, and we also manage events for other organizations. And it's an organization, or it's a consultancy that I co-own with my husband. And John Gooder actually came together in 2014. We established it in 2014, but it's been something I've been doing doing like this consultancy thing on the side as a secondary way to raise money and, you know, to earn money. And my husband does the same thing, using the consultancy to manage his sound equipments and all that he does. So it's always been something on the side that we've done. And it was in 2014 that we decided that, hey, let's kind of incorporate it into a limited liability corporation so that in the future, if we want to do anything with it, you know, we can do. And that was actually also like at the end, or right when I was thinking of transitioning out of the school district as well. I wasn't exactly sure where I wanted to go, but I knew that I wanted to do something different. And so, you know, we decided that why don't we just create our own stuff, right? And just start doing things. And, you know, I was doing a lot of professional development and learning myself about training and all, and I wanted to experience that. So we did that, and what we did was my husband is a photographer too, and he had this company called Gooder Photography. And so I was like, Gooder, well, or I gave him that name, Gooder Photography, because he was like, hey, help me with the name. I was like, well, just call it Gooder Photography, you know? It's grammatically incorrect, but it's so awesome, right? Like, it's like, it's not great, it's not bad, so whatever, you know, it's Gooder, you know? And so he took that name. And so when we said we wanted to incorporate, we took his first name, John, and Gooder, you know, which is the name I wanted. And together we created John Gooder.
That's so interesting, because I've always wondered where Gooder came from. I've always thought it was an additional last name, or maybe it was a middle name, but now that makes so much sense. So anyways, people who know you know that you are an active contributor to the community. Not only are you doing the work you are through John Gooder LLC, but you are putting together many projects, and you have one that is coming up very soon. So tell me about that one.
It's so it's happening on July 20th in Sacramento, and it's called the Hmong Midsummer Night Market. This year, we've actually are transitioning the event over to United Hmong Shaman Temple. They're a local nonprofit. We wanted to create opportunities where we're supporting our local nonprofit, and this is a perfect way to, you know, build capacity in our local nonprofit so that they can do more of these things. So United Hmong Shaman Temple is our hosting partner. And yeah, it's just a night of meeting young artists, Hmong artists, artisans, you know, young entrepreneurs, startup business, information booth. We have the city of Elk Grove coming out. They're a strong supporter for this work. They're a sponsor as well. I believe the mayor is going to come out, so we're excited to have Mayor Steve Lee come out and speak to the crowd.
What started this whole idea?
You know, it was something that we wanted to do because what I noticed was there was a lot of individual business happening on, you know, online, you know, especially on Facebook and Etsy and all these other channels. And I was thinking, wouldn't it be great if we had more venues where people can kind of showcase their work and meet their audience? You know, like you buy from someone online, but hey, here's an event where you can actually meet them. You can talk to them about how they came up with the ideas. And it was also a way to provide venue space for artists and artisans to start selling their stuff. And then at the same time, we realized that, oh, nonprofits can, you know, kind of do a fundraiser if they are a food booth and they can raise money that way. And so it was just an event that we put together last year, and then this year we'll have it happening again. And then we're hoping next year we can continue to host this throughout, you know, forever if it happens.
And this is exactly what I mean when I say you are a philanthropic human being. You do a lot of work and put a lot of community projects together, but you are always helping people to establish themselves, which is what I truly admired about you and appreciate so much because of your generous heart. Now, this brings me back to your quote, children grow without permission. Whether you're with them or without them, they grow. With your hands always busy and you being in many different places, what has been one of the most challenging parts of being a mother?
I think that I want to answer that in two ways. So one is, what is the best support you can do for yourself so you can do that? And then what is the biggest challenge? So I want to go with the first one first, which is the best support that you can put for yourself so you can do that is finding a partner that believes in you and a partner that is there with you. So I'm going to go with that first, okay? And so for me, I'm not able to do all this business and all this like extra work that I do for the community, or, you know, sitting on boards, or just like, or focusing on, you know, different consultancy opportunities. You know, for me, all of that, even like my regular jobs in the past, I can't do that if my husband isn't supportive of that. Because it doesn't lead us towards our goal, you know, which is, you know, we want to grow old together and retire and, you know, still have a partner, you know, a lifelong partner. And we get it that we're in a place right now in our life where we have children, and our children are our best investment, you know, like to invest in them both, you know, in themselves, and, you know, create a legacy in the future if they find themselves in need of something, that we did all we could to give them that leg up, you know? And so to do that, you have to be busy. To do that, you have to network. To do that, you have to hold, you know, position, you know, where you make decisions, and that means lots more work that you have to do. So to support yourself so you can do what I do, I would have to say, find yourself a partner who's going to join that journey with you. And to appreciate your partner when they do that. And earlier I mentioned, you know, he's like the main parent, you know, and it's something that he wants to do. It's something that I'm okay with him doing, you know, and it's something that actually supports our larger goal. And that's to give our kids the best opportunity possible. And if we're doing something that kind of derails that, then we don't do it, you know. But if we do something where we know we're creating better opportunities for our kids, then we're going to do it. So that's one thing. The biggest challenge that you have is this thing about like perception, right? So for me, my biggest challenge is that, you know, I don't want people to see me in a way where, you know, where that it's easy, you know, that what I'm doing is, she must be, you know, it's a lot of hard work, you know. The challenge is to get people to understand that there's a lot of hard work that goes into it for things to actually happen. And I think the challenge for me is that, you know, for me, you know, I'm in a place where I have to compete against a lot of other people when I'm doing things. And so it's challenging because sometimes, you know, I'm the only small woman there, or the only woman, or the only, you know, minority sitting at those tables. And it's challenging to not feel discouraged sometimes, like, oh my gosh, I shouldn't be here, you know. But I think for me, it's always like reminding myself that, yes, you know, I work hard. I deserve to be at the table too. You know, yes, I'm capable of leading. Yes, I'm capable of that position. You know, I'm working with these type of people, you know, or holding this type of job. So the challenge for me is always like, you know, changing that mindset for myself to not feel like I don't belong there. Because, you know, the moment you feel that way, you quit, right? The moment you feel that way, you don't do it, and nothing comes out of it. So I think for me, like, just always having that mindset is the biggest challenge for me, because, you know, sometimes it's just easy to say, okay, you know, I can go do something easier. I can stop giving, you know, and just focus on my kids, let's say, you know. But my husband understands this too. It's like, you know, I've been given opportunities and experience, you know, and I just feel like it would be such a waste if I didn't do anything with it. And I would disappoint a lot of people that put a lot of investment in me and not doing anything with it. And then the other thing too is like, you know, our mom community is in a different, like, it's at a tipping point where there's so many of us now very capable of doing things that we can start lifting all of our community, you know, up to be in those places with us, you know? And I just, you know, that's kind of what I want to focus on. And that's, you know, what I'm doing with John Gooder. And I hope that I can do this, you know, for the community. The biggest challenge is, you know, our community's been jaded before, you know, like where, you know, people come and, you know, they don't do the things that they say they're going to do, or not provided in a way in which, you know, people are hoping for. And so trust is, you know, a big challenge too. But what I find is that, you know, the Hmong community is a really giving community, and everybody, you know, as long as you bring the quality that you say you will do and you're consistent in what you do, that, you know, people will support you. And so far I've been able to do what I do is because people show up. People show up to participate, and people show up to support by, you know, giving money, or, you know, by being a vendor or whatever, you know, like people show up, you know, and they support one another. So, and I just feel like right now, again, that tipping point, we have a whole generation of new folks, you know, who can't actually change our community for the better. And there's people, you know, in the right places now to actually support that to happen.
I'm really hoping we can take this conversation and continue to have it outside of the podcast because we're coming up on the hour. I hope there is a space where parents can come together to have these kinds of conversation around parenting because, like I've mentioned, I believe there is a huge learning gap between parenting and child development in our community. Even myself, sometimes my actions do not reflect what I hope to instill in my children because of a lack of knowledge. With that said, I have two final questions to ask you. The first question being, at the end of your mother experience, how will you know you have been successful?
You know, that's a pretty hard question because there's the question of like, how do you know you're successful? And how do you know your kids know you're successful, right? So I have just certain goals that I just hope that my kids like hit, right? So one is like graduate from high school and not be pregnant, right? I mean, things like that. I mean, serious things, like I had three girls, you know? And it's like, you know, like, so I want them to finish high school and not get pregnant, right? I want them all to go to college because I just feel like that's so important for them, you know? And then I just want to make sure that as a mother, like that they're kind, you know, that they're kind people. And that then as a mother that I've left behind, you know, some kind of legacy, whether it's resources or like something so that my kids can still have that leg up, you know, when they're ready to do whatever it is they want to do. And I think that for me, that's how I would define success. But, you know, for my kids, you know, I don't know how they would, you know, score me on being a mother. Yeah, because I think, again, every phase of their life, you know, I'm probably either successful or not successful.
Yeah, I think that's one thing that a lot of us are most afraid of, you know, as mothers, where, you know, how are my kids going to see me when they're much older? So that's, I think that's one thing that most mothers are afraid of. And so that leads us to the next question, which is, what is one piece of advice you would give to mothers?
That if you do the best you can do, then no one can ever say that you do what you were supposed to do, you know, as a mother, you know, because it's so hard to compare yourself to other people because, again, you know, your situation is different than everyone, you know. And I would go back to that quote again about how children grow without permission. So, you know, value that time that you have together. And if you're in a tough, you know, point in your life right now with your kids, just know that that too will pass. And, you know, as long as you do the best you can do, yeah, no one will falter for it.
Huh? Thank you so much, Kua. You know, this hour that we've spent together has been very valuable. I've learned so much. You know, I'm learning different things every time I speak with moms. And so thank you so much for giving us your time.
No problem. Again, thank you for having me.
My gosh, Kua, you are just amazing. Our conversation today does not even encompass half the person she is or the range of knowledge she has. When I say she is one of the most benevolent person, I mean it. It is hard to find people who will jump at you to help with no hesitation, and I'm just blessed to have Kua as that individual. We did not get to go too deep into details on what her work entails, and to say she creates opportunities just isn't enough. Kua has a repertoire of skills and tools in developing leaders, developing strong teams, and designing success. I encourage you to follow her work, attend her workshops, set up a one-on-one coaching session, or have coffee with her. Get to know her because you won't regret it. I can only see how she will move you forward, never backwards. That is it for today. I hope you enjoyed this episode and will continue to join me in the upcoming episodes. I would love to hear from you all what particular topics you would like to hear from me or from our guests, and would appreciate it if you can leave a review to let us know how we are doing. To leave a review, you can visit the Facebook page under Circle of Mothers, Apple Podcasts, or Google Play and tell me everything you liked or would like to hear on the podcast. To stay up to date, follow the podcast on any one of the websites where you leave a review. I love you all, and we'll talk to you next time. Bye.